Hey, you guys, thank you so much for joining me on the Thoughtful Discuss podcast. Thoughtful Discuss is the home for avowed centrism and sober analysis, where thesis and antithesis are heard equally in an attempt to form a reasonable synthesis. Join me here for a sensible take on our increasingly polarized public discourse. Okay, so yesterday, Joe Biden announced that he was going to exit the race and open the door for his vice president, Kamala Harris, to enter the race. Today, we are doing a postmortem on the Biden presidency, and we are going to take a real look at what the legacy is here and give Joe Biden a grade as a president. Okay, so if you listen to the Trump campaign about who Joe Biden is and what his presidency has been, you probably think that Joe Biden is one of the worst presidents of all time. If you were to listen to Joe Biden and his surrogates and the people in the Democratic Party, he's of course one of the greatest presidents who's ever lived. And wouldn't you know it, if you really look at the facts, the truth is somewhere in the middle. Joe Biden is probably a B, maybe a B minus as a president, and we're going to look at all of the facts that comprise my take of who Joe Biden is, what his presidency was like, and how history will view him. I've broken down this podcast into three sections. Obviously, it's not going to be as comprehensive as you'd get from reading a very long history or from a multi-hour podcast, but we have three categories here. We have domestic policy, foreign policy, and personhood. Okay, I think these are pretty self-explanatory, so let's just get into it. So on domestic policy, let's start with the economy. Here on the Thoughtful Discuss podcast, we are interested in the facts and the numbers, and we do not care about partisan nonsense. So let's just leave all of that at the door and try to open up our minds. For this side of the conversation, we're going to look at four economic indicators. The first one is going to be gross domestic product. The second one is going to be unemployment. The third is going to be inflation. And the fourth is going to be consumer spending. Now, all of this has to be taken into context with COVID-19, of course. Any broad comparison between the Biden administration and the Trump administration is going to be very difficult. It's very complicated by the disruptions that started at the outset of the COVID-19 pandemic in early 2020 when Biden was just on his way to getting elected. And this whole thing that happened there triggered two of the most extreme quarters of economic contraction and growth in U.S. history, followed by a bout of inflation that was reminiscent of the 1970s. Now, should Trump be blamed for a collapse in output that rivaled the Great Depression? Should Biden actually get to cash in on the millions of jobs he created in, you know, in quotes, created in 2021 that were largely kind of a pandemic effect? This is something that is important to acknowledge at the outset. And it's important to acknowledge because guess what? If I told you all of the data about the Joe Biden presidency and the Donald Trump presidency, all the economic data that I'm going to tell you about, and I didn't tell you that a pandemic hit the world that changed everything for forever and that had us locked down for months, the only conclusion you could come to is that the Joe Biden economy was superior to the Donald Trump economy. So first of all, let's look at overall growth, gross domestic product. It's a figure that counts everything that's produced, every meal served, every dollar spent by the government to measure changes in the country's overall output. Now, there are debates about what it really means and how it is distributed, but GDP is one of the main economic scorecards. This is one of the main things that we would look at. Now, generally speaking, the faster GDP grows, the healthier the economy. With many of the broader statistics, other things we're going to look at, like unemployment, what may be more interesting is how similar the Trump and Biden economies look. They are very, very similar in a lot of ways. GDP increases under the Trump presidency annualized to a rate of about 2.7%, and that's about exactly what it was during the first Biden year. The second two had an annual rate at around 2.3%. Which is, of course, less growth, but it's obviously not so much less when you consider that lots of stuff was locked down and there was chaos and calamity across all sectors. Let's have a look at consumer spending. Biden rode what was obviously a pandemic-era consumer spending boom. While Trump's economy saw slightly larger average contributions from business investments, they're two sides of the same coin. Additionally, against many expectations, the pandemic era became one of fast wage growth and corporate profits. And some people link this to federal household and business support programs, and some people attribute this to high inflation. The point is that tax receipts followed. I don't think that you could say that Biden was the author of this, but the truth is that the spike in tax revenue is undoubtedly connected to the economy that he presided over. The biggest sore spot for Biden on the economy has to be inflation, though. And if we notice what inflation is and what it's a measure of, it's sort of as economists predicted. They said that the pandemic response skirted a potential catastrophe, which was a benefit, but inflation represented the follow-on cost to avoiding that disaster. Depending on who you talk to, that is true or false. If you talk to a Republican about that, that's just an excuse. You talk to a Democrat about that, that's transparently true. Looks to me like that's true. Inflation at its highest was 9.1%, which was staggeringly high. That was higher than it's been since the 1970s, but it's down to about 3% now, which is pretty standard. Now, on to unemployment, where the Biden administration made some bold statements, boasting a 3.9% unemployment rate as of April, which was very, very low. Now, a lot of conservatives will tell you, and I tend to agree here, that this is just a talking point and that the real unemployment rate at that time was somewhere between 6.5% and 7.5%. The unemployment rate is the percentage of people in the labor force who do not have a job, right? So that means the unemployment rate can change if the number of people unemployed or the total size of the labor force changes. So the reality is that somewhere between 4.5 million and 7 million people at that time who weren't working on that day are not included when calculating the unemployment rate. And that artificially reduces the figure. You may ask, why were they uncounted? What are you talking about? Well, when the government instituted the draconian lockdowns, most of the economy in response to the COVID-19 outbreak kind of just crippled. 17 million people became unemployed, and another 8 million people immediately left the labor force, right? So as the economy slowly reopened across the country, a lot of people, millions of people, began returning to work, but that, of course, drove down the unemployment rate by reducing the number of unemployed people. The people who were left in the labor force also returned and eventually found jobs, which also reduced the unemployment rate. But there are millions who left the labor market entirely and never returned. So as much as they were no longer counted among the unemployed nor in the labor force, this pushed the unemployment rate down even more. So the unemployment rate there, kind of a wash for the Biden administration. Let's take a look at the broader things that went on in the domestic policy sections of the Biden regime. One of them that was important to him was drug prices. And without a doubt, he made some progress here. Now, he wanted to negotiate prices for more drugs. At the State of the Union, he said that Medicare should basically be allowed to negotiate prices for at least 50 drugs per year, up from the target of 20 per year. There was a wider range of drugs that he wanted negotiations going on with, and the change would have required congressional action, but the White House officials said that basically it could reduce all the federal spending by tens of billions of dollars annually. It was a good idea. Now, since Medicare has prices set that influence what private insurers can charge, it could lead to lower drug prices for Americans who aren't covered by the program. The quintessential campaign sale of this policy probably was in the form of Joe Biden bragging about what had been done to insulin prices. Let's just take a quick look. About 8.5 million people in the United States control their blood sugar levels with insulin, and about 1 million people have that type 1 diabetes and could die without regular access to it. The White House says 4 million older people qualify for the new lower price. Now, the price cap for Medicare was part of the Inflation Reduction Act, actually, which sought to cap insulin at $35 for everyone who had health insurance. Now, when it came across in 2022, it was scaled back by, of course, Republicans who wanted for it to only apply to older folks. The Biden administration then announced that there were agreements with drug makers like Sanofi, Novo Nordisk, and others to cap insulin copayments at $35 for those with private insurance. They accounted for more than 90% of the U.S. insulin market. It made a huge difference, no doubt. But Biden oversold it. He constantly said that it was $400 a month, which is a huge overstatement. There was a Department of Health and Human Services study that was released after he said that, that found with people who had diabetes, who were enrolled in Medicare, had private insurance, probably paid $452 annually, not monthly. So it was about 12 times less than he was saying it cost. If that is true, then he really didn't bring it down so much at all, maybe just a little, but time will tell. Let's move over to foreign policy, where there is a record for Joe Biden that is marred somewhat by the decision to get out of Afghanistan, where we had a presence for a very long time after launching a war over there. I'm just going to state broadly my view real quick, and then I'll go over some of the facts. Joe Biden got out of Afghanistan in a very, very bad way, in a way that did not look great for the cameras, in a way that produced some really, really nasty headlines, but he actually did something that his predecessors were too cowardly to do. Obama didn't want to get out. Donald Trump didn't want to get out. They were scared to do it. So what exactly happened? Well, in February 2020, to start, the Trump administration and the Taliban signed a deal, the United States Taliban deal in Qatar, which stipulated that fighting restrictions for both the U.S. and the Taliban, and in return for the Taliban's counterterrorism commitments, which is strange. They were going to give us, the Taliban was suddenly our friend. Weird. But the idea was that they provided for the withdrawal of all NATO forces from Afghanistan by May 1, 2021. It was sort of a half-measured position. Now, after the deal is struck, the U.S. reduces the number of air attacks on the Taliban, and this plan starts going into motion. The Biden administration starts having this plan executed. Ultimately, they decide to leave on May 1st, 2021, but the final pullout of all the troops was delayed until September of 2021, which resulted in the collapse of the Afghani forces that we had trained over there, and the Taliban eventually took over. So let's just be clear about what happened here. In the aftermath of this U.S.-Taliban deal, the U.S. just completely stopped supporting the Afghan military in its offensive operations, which made it so they could only take defensive positions around the country. In the agreement, it actually says that U.S. military aircraft could not attack Taliban groups waiting more than 500 meters away, which obviously was going to give the group a serious strategic advantage in targeting the Afghan military units. Remember, the Afghan military units are sort of the troops we trained up to fight the Taliban. It also really harmed the morale of the Afghan army and police, which made them more open to accepting bargains with the Taliban. And due to a lack of information sharing that had not been, you know, anywhere near what was going on in Afghanistan at the time before this, the Taliban were totally able to spread propaganda and disinformation about the agreement. Those are the bullet points right there. Other nations, including Germany, follow suit and they get out of Afghanistan. And this results in a lot of chaos in Afghanistan. Lots of innocent people get killed. Lots of the Afghanis that we had trained up get killed. A lot of people get upset about this. And we get the Kabul airlift, which is where the lion's share of the screen time goes on the news. In August of 2021, the Taliban seizes that capital city, Kabul, as the government under President Ashraf Ghani dissolves completely. And the speed of which this happened, it just happened so quickly. No one was prepared for it. The news cycle wasn't even prepared for this. Then Taliban fighters surround the city of Kabul. The U.S. embassy is evacuated and retreated to Hamid Karzai International Airport in what is a very famous and dramatic incident or scandal, depending on your perspective. It really looks mismanaged to me here. There is a coalition of troops here, including Americans, British, Italian, Turkish, as part of NATO personnel on the ground there. It's like 5,000 U.S. troops. The government later authorizes the deployment of 1,000 additional troops from an 82nd Airborne to the airport, which increases the troop presence in Kabul to maybe 6,000 to facilitate evacuations. That's the way they put it. After Kabul falls, the military withdrawal evolves into just an airlift of all of NATO's diplomatic staff, at-risk Afghan and Western nationals, and maybe some refugees able to enter the surrounded Kabul airport, which prompts Western countries to send in additional troops to facilitate the evacuations. Now, on August 16th, the UK agrees to send 200 additional troops to Afghanistan, bringing the total number of British troops in the country to 900. Everyone's starting to see they need to rebring presence back into the country because this is being botched so terribly. And there's a suicide bombing at the airport, which kills 11 Marines, an Army paratrooper, and 170 Afghan citizens. Now, in terms of an international disaster, in terms of the scale here, it's relatively small, but it underscores how bad this plan was and how badly it was executed. No doubt, it's a stain on Joe Biden's administration. Let's talk about Israel. The situation in Israel started when, on October 7th, a group of Hamas-led militants led a surprise attack into Israel in which they used a rocket barrage and thousands of militants who came across the border attacking Israeli civilians and military bases. During the attack, it's like 1,300, maybe more, Israelis and foreign nationals were killed, maybe up to 800 civilians and 373 security personnel. About 251 Israelis and foreigners were taken captive into Gaza, and Hamas said its attack was in response to Israel's continued occupation, blockade of Gaza, and settlements expansions, as well as alleged threats to the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the plight of Palestinians. Now, Joe Biden's response has mainly been to support Israel in what eventually became their incursion into Gaza. Since that time, it has to be acknowledged that for the most part, people in the West have been both verbally and financially supportive of Israel's cause. Okay? Israel has been using American-made weapons against all of its foes for a long time. This hasn't just started here. But since October 7th, the Biden administration has made more than 100 military aid transfers to Israel, although only two, which are about $250 million each, met the congressional review threshold to be made public. Now, the Israeli military has received expedited deliveries of weapons from a stockpile that already existed in the United States for this exact purpose, and one that was maintained in Israel since the 1980s. This infrastructure has existed for a while. But right after the Hamas attack, the United States also decided to lease Israel two Iron Dome missile defense batteries that Washington had previously purchased from the country. So they gave them back two of these things that they had purchased for a cushy leasing agreement. The flow of aid between America and Israel is extraordinary. There's no denying that. It's included tank and artillery ammunition, bombs, rockets, small arms, the whole battery of things, everything you can think of that is used for killing people. In April of 2024, the Biden administration was considering even new military sales to Israel that are valued at more than $18 billion and include 50 F-15 fighter aircrafts and shipments that might not arrive for years but would start soon. The Israeli military was also reportedly purchasing some high-tech products like surveillance drones directly from smaller U.S. manufacturers, getting some good deals on that stuff. The view of this war inside the United States did transform categorically when thousands of Gazan civilians were killed in the process, which everyone should have seen coming. I think that for the Biden administration, the most important thing to understand about Joe Biden's role in this is that Joe Biden has historically been a very pro-Israel guy, and guess what? The United States has always been a very pro-Israel country. Now, there's all kinds of little laws that exist in the way that we interact with Israel that make it so their military advantages can't really be infringed upon by the normal ways that you would think that a military could infringe upon the nature of a conflict. For example, there's the qualitative military edge. And the QME, as it's called, is basically a backbone of U.S. military aid to Israel, and it was put into law in 2008. It says that the U.S. government has to maintain Israel's ability to defeat credible conventional military threats from any individual state or possible coalition of states or from non-state actors while sustaining minimal damage and casualties. Now, that is based on essentially making sure that the United States doesn't sell weapons that compromise the quality of Israel's weapons, like that the quality of weapons must be higher when we send them to Israel. So really, any president in the position that Joe Biden was in probably was going to end up in a position where they were going to drastically empower Israel's militaries. I don't want to include this as a positive or negative here because I think history is going to tell the tale, but please count me in as thinking that democracies and technocracies like Israel are worth being allies with and worth defending on the world stage. So what's the story of Joe Biden and Ukraine, the other really, really massive foreign policy question at this point? I think the story is basically that Vladimir Putin thought that he was going to walk into Ukraine and not suffer any real repercussions, and truthfully, he has suffered repercussions. How far we should actually go in acknowledging them as being American repercussions to his actions? This is a genuinely interesting question. There's no doubt that today the Russian military is actually stronger than it went into Ukraine. But there are also other parts about this, the ethical legacy of a conflict like this, whether or not we are the world police, and whether or not we are having a spiritual crisis, and whether or not we want to be that. All of these questions are in here. Joe Biden initiated what was fundamentally a Cold War response to the actions of Vladimir Putin, which were to try to weaken him as much as possible from within and to make him a pariah on the world stage. I would say a lot of that has worked. I don't think he was willing to say the quiet part out loud, though, which was that it's good for Russia to be weakened while none of our soldiers go off there and die. Now, there's a part of this that is a money question to a lot of people. As a percentage of GDP, and even just as a percentage of our military budget, we've not sent tons of money out to Ukraine. I understand that that's a very hard pill for people to swallow when they see billions of dollars going to places like Ukraine when some of our communities need help. But at the same time, there are benefits to being the police of the world. One of them is that we control the flow of products and goods. It's good that we are very much on top of the game in terms of military technological sophistication, although it seems like we're being beaten out by China at an ever quicker rate. There are ups and downs to being the world police. That being said, Joe Biden did not botch anything about Ukraine. Joe Biden warned the American people that this was happening. You can argue that he's given them too much money, but I don't think he made this worse, and I think there's a good chance that the response that was given here will be seen as a deterrent to future would-be dictators and autocrats about what can happen if you do invade a country like Ukraine. Last, we have the personhood of Joe Biden, and this is the place where I get most frustrated with everyone who wants to lionize Joe Biden and everyone who wants to try to act like he's above the muck of Washington. Joe Biden is the muck of Washington. There's no doubt about that in my mind at this point. I think the 1996 campaign for president bears out just how much of a political animal and how much vain ambition is just completely everywhere, all over the heart of Joe Biden. But there are a number of other things that show he's just not that much of a stand-up guy at all. I mean, he wouldn't acknowledge his youngest granddaughter. That's not right-wing propaganda. That's nothing. That is, his son had an out-of-wedlock child that he refuses to acknowledge as a granddaughter. And I think that that is a horrible, horrible thing. It shows that he is not as great a person as everyone wants to make him out to be. But let's go over some of the other facts, too. He did lose his wife in a tragic car accident, and he lost one of his sons to a tumor. Now, this obviously changes a person, but a lot of this stuff happened a little bit later on in life. You know, he lost his wife a little earlier on in life. But there were things that just have always been true about Joe Biden, even in the way he crafted policy, that showed a complete unwillingness to rectify elements of his personality and consolidate his actual politics and policy with who he was. For example, Joe Biden is a guy who was extremely tough during the drug war. There is a moment where he even got behind a bill that was going to have the death penalty for drug dealers. Now, not just any drug dealer, a drug dealer who had been in some way connected to any kind of a loss of human life. He was going to connect that to a potential death sentence, which, given his future years' assault on the death penalty and his wish to get rid of the death penalty, there was definitely a sense among some Democrats that he had renewed and reinvigorated his policy stance and had brought them up to date. But I mean, he is one of the guys who really brought on the drug war. He proposed legislation that was going to have anyone found with a small amount of crack cocaine going to jail for 5 years, and this was something that really had a disproportionate effect in some of the more drug-addled communities in the country. It wasn't a policy that was based around rehabilitation. This is one of the words that we hear a lot. One of the buzzwords is rehabilitation these days. This is not what the original idea was, and Joe Biden did all of this stuff, and then his son became a crackhead. Okay, I hate to put it in those terms, but that is exactly what happened here. And if there's been any softening of the rhetoric, if there's been any increased empathy on the part of Joe Biden, that is why. Is Joe Biden operating a crime family? No. All of our presidents in the recent past and in the past have had a economic opportunity presented by their influence that we have always turned the cold shoulder to and that we've always ignored. So I'm not going to go as far as to saying that him peddling his influence for money makes him corrupt. I don't think that it had a substantial effect on his policies, although there is some questions in Ukraine. But the fact that Hunter's shortcomings, Joe Biden's son's shortcomings, became such a liability for Joe Biden as a president is telling. It's because there weren't that many things that you could drag up about his actual corruption activities that had anything to do with that campaign or the way he's governed. Straight up, the guy had a history of doing policies, of proposing policies that were manifestly wrong, that were ill-informed, and that had the bad intentions at the core of them. And I think those bad intentions really did maybe come from the heart of a guy who He was in the Senate when he was 30. The only place up for him to go was president, and he spent basically the better part of 50 years doing it, which is why the last thing about Joe Biden has to be said. His inability to let go of the presidency until the last hour here, to relinquish his campaign until every single person told him he couldn't do it, shows a level of psychological irresponsibility that you would be right to compare to what goes on in Trump's mind. It is a level of narcissism. It's sort of like those, if a nuclear bomb explodes, certain cockroaches will survive while all the humans die. While Joe Biden was cognitively declining, the parts of his brain that suggested we have to hold on to power were invincible. The only things he really remembered in these last couple months is that I fought for this my entire life, and I will hold on to it, even if it kills me and destroys the civilization I'm in. I really think that that part of this is that bad. All around, we are giving Joe Biden a B- for his presidency. We are weighing more heavily his policy than his personhood. Thank you for joining me on this episode of the Thoughtful Discuss podcast.